session number 9708, reel 1.
Sir Bernard Lovell, Reel 1. What was your reaction, Sir Bernard, when you heard in September 1939 that we were at war with Germany?
It was not unexpected. Remember that we had lived through several years of great tension, and only the previous year we'd had the Munich crisis. In August of 1939, I had been one of the group of young men introduced to the secrets of radar. And in fact, when Chamberlain announced that we were at war with Germany, I was in the operations room of one of the chain stations at Staxton World in Scarborough. It was a dramatic moment, as it turned out, because we were being trained there. I'd been there for a week or so, and I was looking over the shoulders of one of the WAF operators. And as Chamberlain was speaking on that Sunday morning, the screen, Catherine Rachel's screen, was full of short-lived echoes. And I said to the girl, "Why don't you report these raid to the Stanmore, where the control room was?" And there's a fighter command control room. She said, "Oh, they're not aircraft; they're ionosphere." Well. She was right, but the mystery of those echoes, of course, lived with us. And Wilson, J.G. Wilson, a colleague of mine, we said they may well be radar echoes from the ionization caused by large cosmic ray air showers high in the atmosphere, which Wilson and I had just been studying in Manchester. And that's another story. But in fact, it was that, as Chamberlain was announcing the war, which led to Jodrell Bank as it is today. Because Blackett and I wrote a paper during the war on the possibility of using this technique, to radar technique, to investigate these large cosmic air shows. And after the war, I'd forgotten about it, but Blackett reminded me that I was going to do this. And I eventually got a couple of trailers of equipment I'd been using and brought them here. Had permission to stay here for 2 weeks. That was at the end of the war. So that's another story. So you see, my emotions and reactions, in answer to your question, are very interesting. I mean, but for that, we wouldn't be here today.
But you thought that that might be a German knockout blow, did you?
I did indeed. And of course, those are people who were in London, the air raids were also going then. But so that's the answer to my question. But it was not unexpected to people of my age. 1939, I was born in 1913, so I was a young man, 26, and we had all in the month of August, when it seemed quite certain, early August, when it seemed quite certain that there was going to be a war. I'd been one of the group of young men who'd gone to Bolsey Manor, had been initiated into the secrets of radar. It felt absolutely astonishing. I mean, I'd been working with Blackett, who, as you know, was a member of the Tizar Committee, which had really been responsible for the development of this development of the chain station, and yet I knew nothing about it. Such was the secrecy in those days.
Could I ask you about Blackett? Could you tell me what kind of a man he was?
Yes. Blackett was a very, very remarkable man. I have written his biographical memoir for the Royal Society, which was published as a separate book some years ago. I don't know how much you want me to tell about Blackett, but he was, as you know, he was a lieutenant in the Navy in the First World War. He was in the Battle of Jutland, and he was after the war. The Admiralty sent the people whose career had been interrupted. He was at Dartmouth to Cambridge for a refresher course, and he went there as a lieutenant in the Navy. And the first night he was there, he just strolled into the Cavendish Laboratory, and it changed his life. He decided to get out of the Navy and go back to study under Rutherford. And, of course, he became one of the great scientists. Well, shortly after that, I I became one of his young men and worked with him and knew him extremely well for the rest of his life.
What was he like on a personal basis?
He's extremely handsome and dramatic. I mean, he would not suffer fools gladly. One of the most acute intelligences that I've ever encountered, and a man of enormous experience. After all, he had, apart from his naval career, which gave him the contacts which were to be very important later in his life, he was one of the most eminent scientists of the 20th century. He became distinguished, not only he became famous for his investigations of the disintegration of the atom in his early Cambridge days, and then in the 1930s he investigated cosmic rays, became a great cosmic ray physicist. And that's when I first became associated with him, because I came to Manchester as a young man in 1937, and Blackett came almost immediately afterwards as the Langworthy Professor of Physics. And from that time, he used to live with us quite a lot. And then he was a member of this famous Tizard Committee. And there was this great conflict, of course, between Tizard and Blackett on the one hand and Charwell on the other, which is a very important story, which has often been written up. And so Blackett, during the war, he started operational research in the services, first of all with the Army, and then with the Coastal Command, and then he became the Director of Naval Operational Research, DNOR, in the Admiralty. And after the war, he became an expert on magnetism, and then he was associated with Harold Wilson in the initiation and development of the scientific policy for the country, which led to this famous Wilson speech in Scarborough in 1964, you know, the white hot heat of the technical revolution. Blackett, when Lord Wilson was Prime Minister, I had to see him to find out the details of his liaison with Blackett. And Wilson was really, he could talk about nothing else. It was in one of the great financial crises, but Wilson could talk about nothing else but Blackett. It was really amazing. Memorable afternoon in Downing Street. And I said, well, why did you not make Blackett the minister? For Minister for Technology, because all the idea of the Ministry of Technology had been, it was Blackett's idea, you see. And he said, because I wanted to screen him from the rough and tumble of politics. And he said, but if he had then been willing to have gone to the House of Lords, he would have, the situation would have been quite different. But instead, Blackett became the chief advisor, I think, to the ministry. Then he became Fellow Royal Society. He's a very, very great man.
When you knew him in those early days, did he show any sign of interest in politics?
Oh, yes, very much so. He was often accused of being a communist, but this was quite wrong. He was never, never a communist. Although he was immediately after the war, he was not allowed, during the McNulty period, he was not allowed into America. And he was actually imprisoned on Ellis Island when his plane he was in had to make a forced landing or ran out of petrol and landed in New England instead of Canada. But he was never a communist. He was a Fabian. He was left, a good Fabian.
Can you remember what type of things he used to say to you personally about politics?
About politics? Oh, well, he would be scathing with young people like myself who did not entirely share his political views of the world. I mean, he would say we were not living in the world as it existed, you see. But Blackett, of all the men, Blackett had a very great influence on my own life and many others. You see, this place, there are many reasons why this place would not exist, but it certainly wouldn't have existed if I had not had the tremendous backing in Blackett in the years immediately after the war, when we both returned to Manchester. First of all, he made me get the radar equipment out of the Army and the Air Force and try this experiment, which never came off. And then when we ran into all these other things, he was full of enthusiasm about it and, you know, backed me against the diehards of the university.
When he used to pick holes in your opinions, Was that because you were a conservative at that time?
Politically?
Yes.
Well, I don't think I was. I was never, was not, and never had been particularly ardent, ardent politically. I'm a rather middle of the road person, I think. I suppose when I was a young man, I may once or twice have voted for, on the Labour side, but I imagine most of the time I voted for the Conservatives. It's been my sort of life and background and upbringing, but I've never been really passionate about it. I never really entered into violent political arguments with Blackett. I knew what was going on, but I had a colossal admiration for him. He was a very great man.
Did you like him?
Oh, enormously. Oh, yes, yes, yes. He used to always, for long periods, when we were living near here, where we are now, and after the war, and he had not domiciled himself again in London. He used to stay with us, live with us for long periods. Oh yes, our family is full of epic stories about Patrick Blackett. Great man.
Can you give any?
Well, no. we're not. I mean, I think that if you want this on record, I would, as a record, I spent a very long time and regarded it as a task of great devotion to write the biographical memoir, which has all the facts and expressed my admiration for Black, and this is available in the Royal Society. Do you want the reference of it on the tape?
Oh. Well, I can take it from you later,
yes.
But this element of intolerance in his manner, did it make people feel uncomfortable?
I'm sure it did. Yes, he was so skillful in so many things. He was really rather intolerant of anybody who did not possess his aptitudes. And when I say his aptitudes, I mean his practical aptitudes. He was a very great craftsman. And in the days before the war, when, as I now know, he was involved with the Tizard Committee, he would be up and down from London. He would arrive back in the lab in Manchester, and I can see it now. It's probably why I pull a card out of my pocket now with a lot of notes on it. He would pull a card out of his pocket, and things that he thought of, that Lovell or Wilson or Yarnashy ought to be doing or should do, you see, and he just reeled them off and expected them done instantly. And some of these things involved such skillful procedures that we were not capable of doing them, but Blackett himself was. I mean, he would blow glass making Geiger counters, and he would create the most magnificent pieces of apparatus.
Now, coming back to your own career in the war, you were at Staxton World, you said.
Yes.
How did your career develop from that?
Well, yes, I think there was a few days after that when I was in limbo, and then I received instructions. You see, when the Saxon were playing, I was still what was then an assistant lecturer in the University of Manchester. And then after the war had been going on for about a week, I received a letter from the Air Ministry, I suppose, appointing me as a junior scientific officer in what was then the Air Ministry Research Establishment. And this coincided with the move of the Air Ministry Research Establishment, with Rowe as the superintendent, from Bawdsey to Dundee. And I was posted to work with Dr. E.G. Bowen, Taffy Bowen's group, airborne group, at Scone Airport, which is 20 or 30 miles from Dundee. So I, after the war had been going on for a matter of days, I reported to Burns Group at Scone Airport. And that's where my real story begins.
Can you tell me what your work involved there?
Yeah, I can indeed. The Burns was primarily concerned with the development of a radar for air interception in night fighters. And these were Blenheims. They were fighter bombers, two-engine Blenheim fighter bomber aircraft. And the idea, I learnt later, had been urged by Tizard, because Tizard's view was that when the Germans found that they were being intercepted during the daytime because of the CH arrangements, they would start night bombing. And Tizard took the view that it was absolutely vital to get a radar system in a night fighter. And Bowen, I was put on that game. Now, when I arrived at Scone Airport, Bowen had a very, very crude equipment working on 1.5 meters. There were two transmitting valves mounted on a piece of wood in what was called a squegging oscillator, and this was screwed into the on the inside next near the pilot of the Benham aircraft. There were two dipole areas on the wings, and the idea was to get an echo from an enemy aircraft and fly until you equalized the thing going for them. Now, yeah, so that's what I was put on, installing this equipment, which became very urgent, and trying to get it to work. It was a very crude equipment. There were two fundamental troubles with it. One was that there were very big ground responses, and therefore the maximum range was limited to the height at which you were flying above ground, which in those days was about 10,000 feet. So that everything beyond 10,000 feet, even if you had enough transmitter power, would have been obscured by the ground returns. And there was another fundamental problem, and that was that the pulse from the squaking oscillator was such a poor shape that your minimum range was limited to about 1,000 feet. But on a dark night, you couldn't... I don't know what people say now, but in those days, we used to say that you could see on a dark night, you could, dark adapter, see the silhouette of an enemy bomber at a range of only about 500 to 600 feet. You see, so the minimum range was not good enough. That equipment was installed in battles and Blenheim aircraft, but had almost negligible success. I don't know how many aircrafts it's credited with shooting down, but I think about a year, it had only managed to shoot down one aircraft. And so most of my time was directed to overcoming the deficiencies of this equipment. And shortly after I'd arrived at Schoon Airport and had flown with this 1.5 meter equipment, Taffy Bowen explained to me that we must get over this problem of the maximum range of detection, get away from the ground returns. And he set me on the development of an equipment working on a much shorter wavelength, 50 centimetres at that time, on which we could have more directional areas and get away from the ground. But I don't know how much detail you want in this story, but there was a constant conflict in those days between whether one should do this, do research for the future, or whether the war was so urgent. And the one half Bowen's deputy, Gerald Touch, was saying, look here, there's a war on, for heaven's sake, get on with the 1.5 metre equipment. And Taffy Bowen was saying, yes, all very well, but we really must, it's going to be a long war, we really must make a better AI system. We were moved very quickly from Schoon Airport. I think in November of 1939, we were moved to a new aerodrome, St Athan in South Wales, somewhere near Barry. And this aerodrome was just new. I mean, enormous concrete runways. The Schoon Airport, of course, had been a private, well, it was a private airfield. We took off on the grass and landed on the grass. St Athan, enormous aerodrome. Immense hangars, no heat, no light, no electricity. And this is how we were supposed to do research. And again, this conflict between the immediate operation and needs of the war and doing research for the future was still evident in our group. I remember Tizard and Blackett coming down. And when I told them what was going on, they were absolutely astonished. And Blackett and Tizard went away determined to do something about it. He did two things. He said, because I was more or less working alone on this, I mean, the other chaps in Burns' group were fitting the 1.5 metre stuff in the Blenheims and also in the Hudson aircraft of ASV. And in fact, the two young men who'd come with me from Manchester, Ingleby and Beatty, I'd flown with them in one of these new Hudsons up the Channel, and it was very good. And a few days later, they were doing the same thing, and they crashed into a mountain and were killed. So this was the first of the wartime tragedies, and as a young man, of course, this really seemed terrible because people were not then being killed in their hundreds and thousands. When Blackett heard about this, he said, "Look, we're going to make it so that you really get on with the job you ought to be doing. That is making a short wavelength AI, and I'll send you a nice young man to help you." And this is how A.L. Hodgkin was sent down. From Farnborough. And Hodgkin, you know, became a very famous physiologist. He became president of the Royal Society and Master of Trinity. and became a very great friend. So Hodgkin and I, during that the latter part of that awful winter in St. Athan, began the development of using enormous horns of this 50-centimeter AI equipment. And then in the spring of 1940, we were transferred to Worth M'Travers in Dorset, because the decision had been made to bring the whole of Rowe's establishment, the whole of TRE down from Dundee, which is a very, very unsatisfactory place to go to this purpose-built site where there was already a CH station on the cliffs of Worth M'Travers. And the remnants of our establishment still remain there, and that of course was exotic after the fearful winter in St. Athan. I mean, it was not only a dreadful aerodrome, but the winter, it was one of the severest winters of the century. It's very deep snow and ice for months of that winter. And in Worth M'Travers, Hodgkin and I arrived there before the main establishment, and the director of communications development had told me to find an aerodrome. He said there was an aerodrome at Christchurch for our use. So before Rowe arrived with his main establishment, I drove to Christchurch to find this aerodrome, because I couldn't do any more work unless we had an aerodrome to fly our Blenheims from. And nobody knew anything about an aerodrome in Christchurch. And eventually I went into a shop and said, "Is there an aerodrome here?" And he said, "No, there's no aerodrome. There is a flying field, a private flying field." I found this private flying field, and this was... you see, it's incredible now to think of this lack of understanding. There was a few tiger moss and a clubhouse and a grass field. And I found, remember, I was still a very, very junior chap, and I remember phoning the director of communications development, and he was very greatly displeased at my complaining that there was no aerodrome. And he said, "Oh, well, we will put things right." Well, it took a long time to put things right, and they were eventually Herne Airport, which of course is now quite a big airport. But for a lot of the time at which I'm talking about there, we use this private flying field, grass flying field in Christchurch, and which a lightly loaded Blenheim could just take off and land. It was pretty bumpy to doing so. Well, the epic part, I think, of the whole story occurred on the cliff site at Worth M'Travers after we arrived there in May, the next few months. My job was still, and Hodgkin's, was still to find a transmitting device so that we could get a narrow beam in the nose of a fighter aircraft, get away from the ground return, see to give us maximum range. And we first of all continued with these great horns, and the Air Force people who came down used to look askance and say, "How the hell are we going to get a horn like that in a fighter plane? And one gradually got more experience and got the idea of using a paraboloid. We were still short of power. I was using glass klystrons in those days. And then, I think it was in July of that year, Oliphant came down from Birmingham with the first of the Randall Boot magnetrons, which, of course, about which a lot has been written. And in August of that year, I was working with a person who is now Professor W. E. Burcham, who was another young man who came from Cambridge. And he and I then had two paraboloids on a swivel, and he cabled up, when we got the magnetron working, to these paraboloids, and early in August 1940 we obtained an echo from a Blenheim aircraft, which we think was the first centimeter echo ever obtained flight. Well, I don't know how much of this story you want, but the problem then simply became one of devising an apparatus of this type that would go in a fighter aircraft. And the we were using two paraboloids, one for transmitting, one receiving. The problem of using one paraboloid, as what is called a TR device, common TNR, was solved by the people at the Clarion Laboratory and AT Star. The problem of then, so we could use a paraboloid with a single TNR in a fighter, but then we had the problem, great argument on how to do this, how you have to move this narrow beam around, so a forward look. And I, as we were talking endlessly about this problem, he said, why don't we scan a series of mag slips? Was solved by the people at the Clarion Star. And the problem, so we could use a paraboloid in a fighter, but then we had the problem. And it's a great argument of this narrow beam around, so a forward look with to the aerodrome in Christchurch, as we were talking endlessly about, and said, we time base. With a series, and I said, not a good idea. And they said, he had this absolutely spiral scanner made by Nash and Thompson, a remarkable indication of development in those days, that was AI Mark 7. Within less than a year, the most horns we were using, several miles, which gave a range, I think, in those days of 6 miles on the enemy aircraft. And this became the very famous centimeter AI equipment, first of all Mark 7, then Mark 8. Anyhow, you want my story, because my story very quickly got away from the problems of AI. I mean, how much do you want to know?
How did your story get away from that?
Well, once this initial research had been done and the AI Mark 7 blood, I then explored other systems of locking the guns of the fighter. I developed an AI lock follow system and used to fly that about. And we introduced this also to the army, which they use for their gun laying equipment. Because of course we had all the know-how and all the technique of this new high power magnetron centimetric equipment. But this was not to be my my fate during the war. And because my fate was to be not in the defense, but in the attacking the enemy, and I was soon to be diverted to from fighter command interest to bomber command interest. And since this is, I suppose, the main thing I did during the war, I better tell you how that happened. Do you know any of this story, or if you do, you presumably want it on the tape?
No, very little of it, please, yeah. If you can give as much detail.
Yes. Well, if you read Churchill's war histories, you will find that during 1941 he became very disturbed at the news which began to filter back that the bombers were doing very little damage over Germany. They were their navigation